share with you my story. Would you share your dollar with me?
This is the Wintrust Business Lunch. This is WGN Radio. Pete Zimmerman's your producer. I'm just John Williams, the talking head. And boy, do we have a good series of guests lined up for you today. Ian Schur is always interesting when he comes to us from CNET. We'll talk about the innovation side there, but right now let's talk a little bit about the markets, about the stimulus. Paul Nolte is a partner at Wealth Management, Kingsview Asset Management. Visit kingsview.com. Paul, welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Be back. Nice to be back with you, John.
What are you hearing about a negotiation on the stimulus package? The president said not till after the election, but he seems to be open to a piecemeal negotiation. What are you seeing about this?
Yeah, I'm seeing probably the same that everybody else is. The negotiations continue, and we're now talking more politics than we are talking economics. And is it going to be better for the Republicans if no deal is done? Is it going to be better for the Democrats if no deal is done and we wait until after the election to get it done? So to a certain extent, it almost feels as if the economy and those that are looking for aid are going to be held hostage for the next 3 to 4 weeks until we get past the election.
I understand the frustration with people, though, that feel that, okay, that notwithstanding, the Democrats should at least, I mean, I wonder how sincere the president and Republicans are when they say, let's just do 1,200. Let's just send everybody 1,200. You could pass that as a standalone bill. That's toxic to the Democrats?
Well, because then, you know, Trump can, for the next 3 weeks, tout that, you know, hey, I'm successful. I put money in your pocket. You know, look at what I did for you. So, again, that's the political side of it. And from an economic perspective, certainly when we look at the financial markets, they've been anticipating that something is going to get done. You know, the end of July is when a lot of this stuff rolled off. The markets are actually up 4 to 5% since the end of July. So the financial markets have been anticipating that something is going to get done, and that will be beneficial for the economy, will be beneficial for the equity markets. And we saw the disappointment when that looked as though it was going to fall apart
right. Earlier
in the week, and the markets were down in a percent and a half.
Fell 600, up about 2.5, and then lost about 350, but then gained a lot of it back. I'm talking about the Dow now, but I wonder why, right? I mean, you'd think that disappointment was about having to wait until after the election, and I think we might yet.
Well, and, you know, that was quickly turned around overnight when Trump said, yeah, maybe we can do that piecemeal thing. So originally it looked as though the door had been slammed shut, and then a few hours later, well, maybe it'll be cracked open a little bit if we can get some of this done.
Right.
So it again, engenders a little bit of hope, and that's where the markets are right now, is hoping that it gets done.
If it does, do you think there's still more upside to that? Will the markets trade up again?
Oh, the markets love money. And certainly with interest rates at zero, and they're going to be there for a long time, the Federal Reserve has been very demonstrative about that. The stimulus package that came out in March did a lot of help to the equity markets. So I think additional stimulus is going to continue to help the equity markets, because ultimately those dollars are going to wind up in the coffers of Amazon, McDonald's, Chipotle, Walmart, Target, and we'll see those earnings come through over the next 6 months from those companies.
What do the jobless claims have to do or say about all of this?
The jobless claims, as Orion talked about in the earlier segment, is kind of flattened out. You know, we're not seeing that continued reduction in jobless claims that we would like to see. So it kind of goes back to what letter recovery we're talking about. And, the letter that's getting tossed around now is K. So the white-collar jobs, we're doing okay. Blue-collar jobs are really struggling. And I think that's what's being reflected now in the weekly jobless claims numbers for a lot of the service jobs, hotel, entertainment, et cetera. They're not working.
Yeah, this is a stupid question. I understand what a V looks like. The top part of a K looks like a V. What's a K-shaped recovery?
So the recovery is split in half. The top half of that K is looking pretty good, and that's, you know, those that are able to work from home and continue to work and get a nice income.
Right.
The bottom part of that, Kay, is those that are in the service economy, as we hear about different restaurants and hotels and other establishments that have closed down because you and I are not real comfortable about going about our lives and wandering around in large crowds or are restricted from doing that.
I would call that a W. To me, the second half of a W, I mean, essentially that's what we're talking about, right? You're talking about the bottom half of a K. I'm talking about the maybe downward trajectory or not increasing as quickly as we'd like trajectory of a W.
No, but see, my point is that there's two parts of the economy. There's those that are doing well in this environment that can continue to work from home, and those that have no choice and cannot work from home and cannot earn a living at this point. So that's the two parts of the economy, and we really have split those that are able to do it and those that are not able to do it, and that's the tough part right now of trying to put together a stimulus package and trying to target those areas. But again, it comes back to the health issue. It's not a financial decision. It's a health decision and when people feel comfortable about congregating again.
Visit kingsview.com. Paul Nolte is a partner there, wealth manager. Thanks for your time today, Paul.
As always, enjoy it. Thank you.
Likewise. It's 1220. Ian Schur, editor-at-large, joins us from CNET.com on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hi, Ian.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, but I'm not in the market for a new iPhone. Is a new iPhone coming out?
Yes. Next week, on October 13th, Apple is expected to announce its newest iPhone. The iPhone 12 is what the rumors call it, but it could be called whatever. And the biggest thing about it is that it's going to have 5G wireless. That's the super fast next generation wireless technology that is not just another G, right? It's supposed to be not just fast, but more reliable and all this other stuff. So that's going to be what people are looking toward. And analysts expect this to be a big, big, big launch for Apple, even though we're in the middle of a recession and all these other crazy things going around the world. They expect this to be one of those moments where a lot of people pay attention, and surveys of prospective shoppers show that they will be.
Why?
Well, we're in the middle of like an interesting kind of moment in Apple owner world. So, you know, a lot of people bought iPhones with the iPhone 6 and 6S. That was about 3 or 4 years ago. And that was kind of, a lot of people tend to upgrade their phones now 2 to 3, sometimes 4 years. So they're at that upgrade cycle. Also, this 5G thing has gotten a lot of people's attention. And that is something that tends to draw people in as a really big new technology change. And then finally, Apple is expected to also change the design of the phone. And this will be the first time they've really changed the design in 3 years. And new designs always get people to look. So, between all of those kind of different factors, the analysts out there, for example, one analysis I saw expects that half of phone shoppers this year are going to consider an iPhone, which is an enormous number compared to normal, and that also that a really large percentage of iPhone owners are expecting to upgrade this year. And that those things together suggest a monster kind of event. But that said, because of the recession and the coronavirus and everything else, we don't know for sure whether people, even if they want to buy it, are actually going to be able to afford it.
Do you know what it's going to cost?
Well, I'm willing to put my money on it being the same as this year's phone. So that means $700 at entry, right? $1,000 if you're for the one of the middle line, and then $1,100 for the top tier one. There's a possibility and a rumor of an iPhone mini, which would possibly drop the price even more. And that would be definitely good timing for Apple, considering we're in this mess. But also, on the other end of it, I think it would be probably the dumbest thing you will have ever seen if Apple chooses to raise prices in the middle of this thing that we're going through. So at the very minimum, I expect them to be same prices.
Prime Day is still around the corner, right?
Yeah, that's the other thing, is that Apple's event is going to overlap with Prime Day this year. So Amazon's Prime Day, it's this fake holiday shopping thing that they started a few years ago, has turned into its own, like, Black Friday type event. It's usually in July, but as we've been mentioning, the coronavirus. So this year it's happening October 13th and 14th. It's going to be a very interesting event. And, you know, not only will we at CNET be sifting through all the deals and helping you find them, and we have a lot of tools to help you figure out if you should buy this thing or not and blah, blah, blah. But I think one of the more interesting things as well is I am curious to see whether or not the retailers kind of shift a lot of their Black Friday sales into October, right? And whether they decide, you know what, screw it. I'm going to make sure I get everyone in the door as quick as I can. And that's going to be really interesting. You know, I remember 10 years ago during the last recession, retailers, as we got closer to Christmas and Hanukkah, a lot of retailers would start dropping prices even further. And I'm curious whether that'll happen this year because maybe they see softening demand. Maybe they're worried about how things are going. I don't know. It's going to be interesting.
Yeah. We were talking about that in my house the other day. Can you believe Christmas shopping season is kind of here? We played our first Christmas commercial on my show earlier today, and I don't know if people will spend the money, even if they have it. Is the whole shopping experience going to be so altered they don't do it? Are they so apprehensive about money they don't spend it? Maybe they don't have it. I mean, it's who knows, right?
It's a really big question mark. And, you know, for what it's worth, I think what makes this shopping season different from what it was like in the recession last time is that there's so much of an industry around trying to kind of identify what is worth buying and what isn't. There's a lot of value-oriented industry these days. You know, I look at CNET as a great example of that, right? We actually recommend, well, if this is not worth buying right now, right? And I think that those types of things weren't as aggressively existing 10 years ago. So I'm curious to see how that plays a dynamic as well, right? Because, you know, for example, we have often said, don't buy a TV unless it's Black Friday or March. Right. And or we tell people, you know, to avoid phone deals during this certain time. Right. So a lot of those things are really important things that people have followed. And now with the recession going on, I'm curious whether they're going to be even more judicious as they're going through everything.
Let's talk a little bit about what Facebook is doing. What are they doing about QAnon?
Well, so if you've never heard of QAnon, I really am jealous of you. Somehow you have avoided some of the nastiest parts of the internet, but it's this conspiracy theory. It's very wide-ranging. It involves the president. It is really kind of a nasty conspiracy theory. But one of the things about it is that it is spread all around Facebook, and there's a lot of people on who are not, like, you know, political extreme right who have started getting into it. And Facebook realizes that this has turned into a real problem. So they are actually now starting to ban all QAnon content on their platform, which is very unusual for Facebook. They usually don't take these kind of stands. But as we're getting closer to the election, Facebook is making more and more moves to try and deal with these issues. They're going to ban political advertising a week before Election Day. They're going to be, they're clamping down even more on extreme content and extremists. And I'm curious to see whether that's going to help at all. But it's very clear they don't want us all to wake up on November 4th after Election Day and be like, what the heck happened on Facebook? How did they let this happen? Yeah. They don't want to go through the last 5 years again.
Is there a website for QAnon, and have they deleted that?
So they can't control the website itself, right? But what they what they can do is they can control the groups that exist on Facebook.
Oh, right, yeah, this is Facebook. So yeah, keep going. Yeah.
Exactly. So people who have groups around it, people who make posts about it, all that stuff, Facebook's pulling down and not allowing on their platform.
What about political ads or statements that are deemed hurtful or just inaccurate? What is Facebook doing about that?
It depends, right? So if you are the president of the United States, you get a pass generally, right? Facebook is very remiss, as is Twitter or YouTube, to ever remove anything by our world leaders, particularly President Trump. But as we have gotten to this situation where he himself says more extreme things, I don't think that's a politically dangerous thing to say. As that's happening, the websites themselves are starting to actually moderate these posts. So, for example, anything that people post about elections now, Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, even TikTok have special parts of their websites and apps they've created with basic information about voting, right, and links to local voting authorities. And they do that because they don't want these posts to be like sending out fake things about voting, right? They don't want conspiracy theories to thrive about voting. And that's a lot of what they're doing. So, you know, President Trump might say something about voting, but there will be a link at the bottom saying, hey, here's more information from the actual authorities, the people who run the voting in your state, about what's going on.
Ian Scher from CNET, CNET.com. We just touched on a few of them. Always great content there. Always good to have you on. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks for having me.
Remember when the pandemic hit and a lot of distillers stopped making bourbon and whiskey in the Chicago area and started making hand sanitizer? That's called the pivot. We don't think about that so much anymore, but there's still plenty of companies that are still finding ways to turn their production lines and expertise into not making whiskey, but making something that the pandemic needs. Sometimes it's more frustrating for some companies than others. This is Dave Sproat. He is the CEO of Young Innovations Microbrush, and he posted an editorial or an op-ed, an opinion piece, in a site called FierceHealthcare.com, where he talks about some of the challenges and opportunities for his Chicago-based company. Let's talk to Dave. Dave, you're on WGN. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you today?
Good. What is your company's principal business? What do you all do?
So normally we are a dental consumables manufacturer, and when the pandemic came around, dental was considered non-essential, so we had wound down most of our factories, including Microbrush, which is one of many that we have. And so we were, when one of our teammates discovered the swab, the medical testing swab, and discovered that it looked an awful lot like we make for the dental community. It's got a flocking process to it. And long story short, we worked with Procter & Gamble, one of their arms, as well as Cleveland Clinic and the Department of Defense. And in 8 weeks, we got a product from prototype to commercial and are now producing well over 20 million of the medical testing swabs.
So you're getting rich, right?
Well, not exactly. So what's been interesting along the way is that I thought that the commercial component of it would be the easiest part and the development would be more difficult. And we're just not known. Microbrush is not known in the medical community. We're known in the dental world. We've been around for 30 years making dental products, so we're well known and brand well recognized in that space, but not medical. So we've had to reach out to a lot of different distributors and government enterprises and so on. And in addition to that, we did not take any of the government money that was offered. So we put all of our own money into recalibrating the facility and brought back 80 employees in Wisconsin, as well as other employees were impacted through the supply chain. So it's all U.S.-based product line.
Mm. So you're making what are called nasopharyngeal swabs, right? Those are the things that go into the nose,
right?
And we've all seen that. Many of us have had that test done. Is that still a test in demand? Is there still a need for that product?
Yeah, there certainly is. We talk to people every day, including yesterday we spoke to the National Institute of Health, and you know, they had given us some direction, and they are helping govern the national stockpile. So you know, we're hoping to get some inroads in there. But to answer your direct question, yes, that is still the case. There's other swabs that are now becoming more popular. They're less invasive, and we have the capabilities of making those as well, and one of which is about to be commercialized right now.
If you have 20 million in warehouses and you're known in at least an allied medical field, the dental side, what's the hang up? Why, you would think communities and hospitals would be clamoring for that supply.
Yeah, so to be clear, we have sold millions of them. They have been utilized in healthcare facilities to date. We started commercializing this in late June, and so today we've sold millions of them through various distribution channels, including the government, Department of Defense, and others. It's just that we've produced a lot. We do have a capability in this facility. On the dental side, by way of example, we make about 650 million dental units a year, so it's a very high production facility. So we are one of two that make this type of swab in the United States, and we believe that our production is superior to anybody else's. So we have a high production capability, and we have inventory right now. The answer to your question is just getting the name out there, getting people to understand this. There are people who, early on, when the pandemic hit, try to fill the void with less superior products, those potentially coming from overseas. 3D printed products and the like. And what we decided to do is build one to the gold standard. So there was an incumbent that had had a product in the market prior to COVID, and we built it that specification per our work with Procter & Gamble and Cleveland Clinic and the DOD.
Right.
So,
but I can understand then why, if there's some less inferior products on the market, and you're a newcomer too, that they would look with the jaundiced eye at what you've got, even though your stuff is, as you say, the gold standard.
It does have to be validated. So there's a process that is what I was getting at that has to occur. So the swab needs to get all the way down to the healthcare facility, the respective healthcare facility has to be validated at that level, and then that healthcare facility has to sign off on it, and then they order it through the respective distribution arm that they're utilizing. So it just it just takes time. And so as time has gone on, we've gotten word out more and more.
I'm frustrated for you, but I'm also encouraged by what I'm hearing, Dave. And I have to tell you, I marvel at stories like yours. Maybe you didn't know what a nasopharyngeal swab was 3 months ago. Now you're cranking out millions of the best that are available.
Yeah.
The ability for businesses to sort of change what they're doing and create new products is amazing.
Yeah, it's really truly is a testament to the entrepreneurial spirit of a company that just happened to see this swab, said, hey, this looks an awful lot like what we're making in the dental community, and going from 8 weeks, for those who don't know manufacturing, 8 weeks from basically innovation to commercialization is really unheard of. So we got everybody on board, and the other feel good about the story is we had to furlough about 80 plus employees in that Grafton, Wisconsin facility because, again, dental was not considered essential, and we were able to bring all those employees back, and then probably another 100 in the supply chain were all impacted positively from this. And like I said, we just put our head down, put our own money in it, and you know, I think that over time we believe that we'll be a player in this segment on an ongoing basis. So that's the way we've approached it.
Well, everybody, Christmas is right around the corner. I want you to run out and buy some nasopharyngeal swabs. Nothing says happy holidays.
Yeah.
Like a COVID test. Congratulations to you guys. What a good story. Continued success, and keep us posted on other things you all are up to.
Absolutely, and thank you for the time.
Dave Sproat is the CEO of Young Innovations Microbrush. How about that? 1243. Okay, Steve Grzanich has got more business news.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. McDonald's says its U.S. same-store sales in the third quarter rose nearly 5% as customers ate more Big Macs and McNuggets for dinner. Overall guest counts are still down, but large group orders and a busier dinner business drove the boost. There's a question now about whether all-day breakfast will return to McDonald's. It went on hiatus during the pandemic. A popular restaurateur is calling on Congress to help suffering food service workers. Rick Bayless is asking the federal government to step up and help the workers, most of whom live paycheck to paycheck. By some estimates, a staggering 85% of restaurants across the U.S. could soon be out of business if lawmakers on Capitol Hill don't approve relief. The Museum of Science and Industry in Chicago has a new president and CEO. Chevy Humphrey is the first woman and black American to lead MSI. She's currently head of the Arizona Science Center and succeeds David Mosina. She'll take over in Chicago in January. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Amy Guth will be helpful to us. We've got a lot of questions for her. We usually talk about the airline industry or include a segment in our conversation with Amy about that, but I'm not going to do that today, Amy. Let's talk a little bit about this blockbuster real estate deal in Fulton Market. What do you know about that?
Yeah, I think this is a really interesting story. So Cranes has reported this, Danny Ecker there at Cranes has reported this, that the McDonald's building that used to be the Harpo Studios right there in the Fulton Market District, that was one of the things that kind of the anchor tenants that started making Fulton Market what it is now. It kind of flipped it from this meatpacking district to this huge, very trendy, expensive corridor. They followed Google, but those were kind of the first two big ones. So that building, they are finalizing, a deal is being finalized rather, to buy that headquarters building. It would be the biggest downtown office sale in more than 2 years. If it goes through, right, it's going to be they've agreed to pay more than $430 million for the fast food giant building. It's 575,000 square feet. Now, a lot of people, I saw some people reacting on social media going, well, wait, they're buying it from McDonald's. Why is McDonald's selling? McDonald's doesn't own the building. They lease about just under 500,000 square feet of it from Sterling Bay J.P. Morgan. So they put that building up for sale in February, just weeks before we started seeing COVID showing up in the U.S. So it's kind of quietly been for sale. And it seems to be that, you know, Sterling Bay is looking to cash out on this area of it that pretty much stayed hot, right, during all of the things, during so many economic issues that have hit other parts of the city really quickly. This area was hot before the pandemic, and it's pretty much stayed pretty level, but still, that would be very, very big news if this deal were to go through, which all signs point to it going through.
McDonald's, obviously no longer in Oak Brook. They left there a couple of years ago. Then they go into the West Loop. So where are they going to go now, I guess? Because you're saying that McDonald's is not going to renew that lease. The building's going to be sold. This other Pittsburgh company's going to buy it, right? But then I wonder where McDonald's goes.
Well, so McDonald's has a lease through 2033. So they're around for a while. And that includes the 6,000 square foot restaurant that they have. They have a training facility called Hamburger University there. They have a big chunk of land right there in that building. So they're keeping that lease through 2033. As far as anybody knows, I have no reason to think that they won't renew it. Maybe they'll stay a little longer. I think that's a long way off, and there's a lot of uncertainties between now and then. But it's just a matter of the ownership changing hands. Sterling Bay, you know, we talk about Sterling Bay a lot because they have their name on a lot of things in the city. They're, of course, the name behind the Lincoln Yards mega project. They're doing a lot of these big, big development deals. I was very interested to see what the pandemic would do, what kind of shifts they would make. I really haven't gotten the sense they've slowed down much, and I think they're probably doing these kind of big deals, cashing out on some of the things, big buildings that they have to fund some other projects.
Hamburger University is still there, right?
That's right. It's not going anywhere. Fret not.
Melody Hobson gave what to Princeton?
That's right. So Melody Hobson she's given a donation to Princeton to underwrite a new building. It is replacing one that was named after former U.S. President Woodrow Wilson. Princeton is not saying exactly how much she has given, but it's estimated to be in the tens of millions. To fund this new building. The last time a building like this was underwritten was 2018, and it was from the Revlon Empire, and they gave $65 million. So the speculation is that it's somewhere around that. And, you know, Princeton put out a statement about this, and they said, you know, the time is that we need to recognize Hobson's achievement. Hobson's statement was quite lovely. You know, she said, hey, when I went there, I was the first of my family to go to college, and I felt at home, and I want other students to feel the same. So having the Hobson College building, to her, she said, it is a very personal way of letting people know that our past doesn't necessarily have to be our future. Princeton has really changed their tune on how they feel about Woodrow Wilson's legacy and felt that they wanted to stand behind Melody Hobson's achievements instead of his. And so this will be replacing the building that was named for him.
She's from Chicago.
That's right. That's right. And she's CEO of, or co-CEO, I should say, of Ariel Investments. She is, and this is funded by the Hobson Lucas Family Foundation. That's her and her husband, filmmaker George Lucas. So, between the two of them, sounds like they probably could swing a gift like that.
Yeah, no kidding. No kidding. I wish we had more time. I'd like to talk about that. But also, you pointed out to us that oil output is down because of the Delta hurricane in the Gulf of Mexico. And as a result, we might see some higher prices, too.
Yeah, that's right. And this area in particular, when we're looking at that Gulf, Hurricane Laura came through in August. A lot of that damage still not repaired. And then Hurricane Sally came through right after that and did a lot of flooding. Not as much damage, but it moved a lot slower. So right now, oil production in the area, about 80% of it is closed, and about 49% of natural gas output is closed as of right now just for the safety of workers in that area.
So that'll explain that down the road. Good to hear your voice. Thanks, Amy.
Thanks, John.